Okay, the meeting will come to order. First bill on the agenda is House File 2683, and the chair will move House File 2683 for consideration for possible inclusion in the committee, in a committee report. And we'll, the bill is in front of us, and I understand that we have representatives from Columbus Township here. If you'd like to come down and testify briefly. When we get to that part, House File 2683 is meant to address a concern that has come up across the metro area. A number of legislators have talked to me about it, and it's the concern that some cities will target prime property for annexation, and this can be detrimental, have a detrimental effect on the development of those communities. And what this legislation simply says doesn't deal with the annexation statutes as much as dealing simply with how the annexed property would be treated. And the goal here is to provide some equity in the situation. When we look at the annexation laws, they tend to at times might indicate that they favor consolidation, and sometimes that prevents the orderly development of the adjacent townships that are impacted by that. With that, Chair Mettler, would you like to testify relating to this piece of legislation?
Sure. Thank you, Chairman Vandeveer and committee members. I'm the chairman of the board of Columbus Township. Columbus Township is in the south, are in the eastern part of Anoka County. The southeast corner of our township is where 35E and 35W join on the north end of the metro area. We have been an urban township since, I believe, 1963, and we have acted as a city, although we've certainly been a township legally for all those years. We are on the edge of becoming metropolitan from the standpoint of what's happening in the freeway district. The end of the 90s, we went to the Metropolitan Council and petitioned for inclusion of the 3 square miles along the freeway into the Musa line, and we were granted that, I think in the end of 99 or the first part of the year 2000. Since that time, we've been working to put a sewer in, a municipal sewer, also water, and we're at the point now where the sewer is in, functioning, people are hooked up, businesses are hooked up, the whole area is zoned commercial. We have the water system in progress. We have pipes in the ground, hydrants up. We don't have the well completed, but that will be functional sometime this year, towards the end, you know, later on in the year. We've worked at this a number of years, probably 8-10 years from the time we started. We're still a township. Last summer we filed for incorporation. Before that, it would have been very hard to become a city without the services of sewer and water. Based on what the way we interpreted the advice we got from our professional people. Since we have that, and since we filed for incorporation, the City of Forest Lake has filed to contest our incorporation, as well as trying a petition, I believe is the proper term, to annex part of that freeway district, the east side of the freeway district. We've spent a number of years, a lot of money, a lot of time and effort developing that, and now because of the way the laws are, as we fear, Forest Lake is certainly, they feel that they can come and just take all the assets that we have spent all the time and money and energy and effort developing over the last several years. We have the support of a lot of communities around us in our efforts to become a city and protect our assets, but if we can protect them from a financial standpoint, that would certainly be in our, to our benefit. And we think, basically, from a sense of fairness, that it's just not fair for, because of the way the laws are or the way they're interpreted now, that we can go to all this work, developed area. The only reason that it's being developed is because of the efforts of Columbus Township, and just certainly don't think it's fair that all of a sudden anybody, in this particular case Forest Lake, can come and basically take them.
Thank you, Chair Mettler. You have other testifiers?
Yes.
Mr. Chair, members, my name is Lona Schreiber. I'm the Intergovernmental Coordinator for Anoka County, and I'm here on behalf of Commissioner Rhonda Sivaraja, who is unable to be here, but whose commissioner's district includes the town of Columbus. I have some handouts here, Mr. Chairman. My words will be brief, but I think it would be important for sure if the committee could see at least a copy of the law in 1963, because I think it's a strong case for what the situation is in Columbus Township. The county board has twice taken formal position in support of Columbus Township. On October 11, 2005, they passed a resolution supporting the town's efforts to become a city, and then again on January 24, 2006, they passed another resolution opposing the annexation efforts. And I think what's most important is this handout that you'll be getting. I want you to see that it's a 1963 law, and it's a very unusual law. It provided village powers back in 63, village powers to all of the towns in Anoka County. It's very unusual. I don't know if there's anything like that in any other part of the state. Three of those, there are only three towns left of all those listed in that special law. The others have all now become cities. And our towns in Anoka County have been working towards that day, to the time that they could be cities. And so they've exercised many village powers. And that was before the Metropolitan Council had their jurisdiction over the metropolitan cities and towns. So our towns submit their own comprehensive plans to the Metropolitan Council. They do all their land use plans. They do their highway plans. Those are all submitted as if they were cities operating right now. We don't think it's fair, and we just want the record to show that the county commissioners support fully Columbus's efforts.
Thank you. Okay, would anyone else care to testify in support of House File 2683?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Kent Sillum with the Minnesota Association of Townships. And while this bill did not arise from our association, we are grateful to Reverend Vanderveer and Columbus Township for bringing this issue to the attention of the committee, because we do agree with what the testimony just heard. At this point, when you've got a township that is providing the same services that they would receive from the city, they are functioning under their statute and working within the confines of the Met Council requirements and everything of that sort, the only thing left is the tax base that the city would be going after. And you are, at that point, just playing one community, saying, well, okay, townships, you know, yes, you're playing by all the rules, yes, you're providing all the services, but that doesn't matter. You're still subservient to the city. And this addresses that issue, and we appreciate the intent of it. And I'm not a tax expert, so I'm not going to get into any debate over the formulas or anything of that nature, but we do support the intent and the background that led to this bill. So thank you.
Okay, thank you. Anyone else care to testify in support of House File 2683? Okay. All right. Would anyone care to testify against House File 2683? So it's not unanimous. Mr. Robinson, welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, committee members, and Representative Nelson. First of all, I'd like to thank the chair and the committee for allowing the City of Forest Lake to testify today. We, first of all, would go on record as an opposition to House File 2683. The City of Forest Lake, as Mr. Mettler stated, received a petition from over 50% of the Town of Columbus property owners of the property east of I-35 and contiguous to the City of Forest Lake. The Town of Columbus has also concurrently petitioned for incorporation And the two petitions have been consolidated into one hearing that is scheduled for the week of April 24th, 2006. It is quite obvious that the intent of the bill is to circumvent the current annexation statutes that are in place today by not allowing the annexing authority to capture the increased property taxes that occur through development. The remainder of the community would have to make up the difference to provide all the services required in the annexed area. The author of the bill's intent is to stop the annexation process that is currently taking place, and by doing so, the author is actually infringing on the property owner's right to petition for annexation. The City of Forest Lake believes that the current annexation statutes are adequate to protect the cities, towns, and property owners' rights. And thank you very much.
Mr. Adams, just a couple questions.
Sure.
With regard to the area being annexed, what is the city's reasons for annexing that property?
Representative Vandeveer, that was actually a petitioned annexation by the property owners in that area.
So you're responding to that petition?
That's correct.
Okay. It's my understanding that five of the property owners have changed their position on that, so if less than half were interested, then would the city then stop the process?
Representative Vandeveer, of course, that would not be my decision. That would be the decision of the City Council, and I can't speak for them today.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Robinson, what percentage of Forest Lake's tax base is commercial industrial? Do you know that, roughly?
It's probably 20 to 30%.
And, Mr. Chairman, if I could continue with a few. Mr. Robinson, do you know what this would do to the tax base of Columbus Township, or maybe the town board chair or something would know better?
Well, that's a difficult question for me to answer. I assume you're talking in the fully developed condition.
That would be correct.
I guess I can't answer that today for you, sir.
Do we know what percentage, as it currently sits, what percentage of the township tax base would be taken in? What would be left for the rest of the township to pay for?
Representative Vandeveer, I did do some calculations.
He's Vandeveer, I'm Nelson.
I'm sorry.
Chip, that's all right. You can call me Pete, too, but go ahead.
It would be a very small portion of our tax base under its current condition, and I would believe that under the Columbus's condition is probably very small today.
Representative Nelson.
Mr. Chairman and Mr. Robinson, one of the things I think that I heard you say is that if this bill goes through, that the services to be provided would be then paid for by the rest of the Forest Lake City residents. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Mr. Robinson.
Okay, and then Mr. Robinson, if this land is annexed into Forest Lake, it's a pretty true statement then that any and all services that the rest of the township remaining, they would have a smaller number of people, a smaller number of properties that would have to pay for any and all services that they would incur, you know, looking forward. So,
that would be a correct statement.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Any other questions for Mr. Robinson? Okay. Mr. Mettler, or Chair Mettler, would you?
Okay. Just to answer Representative Nelson's comments or questions about the tax base in Columbus Township. Right now, our total commercial tax base is probably in the range of 20%. That includes the Lake Drive area. It's pretty hard to put an exact number on it. I haven't got the exact number, but it's in that range. As the freeway district development, we have estimates that our tax base for the township could probably, just the freeway district itself, could probably become 40 or more percent, as much as 50% of the tax base for the whole township. So it's very significant to us.
So, Representative Nelson.
I'm wondering, Mr. Chairman, if either one of these guys want to become part of Chisago County, where our average tax CI tax base is a couple of eyelashes below 5%, and that gives quite a bit of weight to North Branch, which really runs about 25%, so you know how poor we are in the rest rest of the county, and some of that land is just right outside Forest Lake. But
and of course, the Music Freeway District will be right now there with you.
Exactly. Thank you.
Mr. Mettler, so you're saying that this land that the city is attempting to annex is, would be about 20% of Columbus's tax base?
If we assume that the freeway district is about split half and half, the 35 basically bisects the freeway district. It's 3 miles high and 1 mile wide, and it's about half and half. It's 3 square miles. There's 1,920 acres of that. Wetlands and roads take up all but about 800 and some odd acres, and if you take the usable buildable acres, and of course you have to count the wetlands because that's part of the runoff and drainage and all that, so it isn't like it's just not buildable, but probably about half, it would probably be split about half and half. So yeah, 20% is certainly a realistic number if we lose just the side tax base in the long run, not right now. I don't know what that number is right now.
Mr. Robinson, is it still the city's position that they didn't know anything about this legislation?
Well, that was my position that I testified the other day. It wasn't the city council's position.
It wasn't. Okay. And so they are aware of this legislation. Have they taken a position on it officially yet?
Not an official position, no.
Thank you. Any other questions from members? Representative Marquardt.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. And I guess I don't know which testifier could answer this. This area that Forest Lake is looking to annex, it sounds to me it currently has sewer and water and roads. I mean, we're talking about an area that would be providing urban services to the annexed area. What's there already currently?
Sewer is in and functioning. Without going into a lot of detail, we've designed a system for sewer and for water to cover that 3 square miles. Actually, the sewer had to precede the water because we needed the permission from Met Council, and we started working on that. And the sewer is functioning. It's hooked up. Gander Mountain, for instance, is up there, is in that. It's hooked up. Coach Trailer is another business. There's some other petitions that have been approved where those will be projects this year. When those projects are done, probably 30% to 40% of the area, I believe, by acres at least, will be serviced by sewer. The water, we've got the lines, hydrants, for probably 25% of the area. We're going out for bids for the well now. In fact, we expect to award the contract within the next week or so. So the water won't actually be flowing in any pipes until this summer or later on this year, let's say. And the rest of it will be by petition as people want those services. So as far as actually in and being serviced, the area is certainly not completely serviced.
Thank you for that. So if Forest Lake annexes that area, you would assume that area, and I presume the services, and yet, for example, on water, the well would actually be still located in Columbus Township, servicing an area that is in the city of Forest Lake. I'm not quite understanding that.
Well, that's why we would certainly just soon not have to figure out that answer to that question. Or it gets very sticky when you try and either divide a sewer system or a water system or try and extrapolate what's going to happen here in the future. So I don't know the answer to that.
Representative Marquardt. Should have voted for the other bill yesterday, Representative Marquardt. We wouldn't have
current state law, when a city annexes, is it a shall or a may as far as paying for the lost property tax base to the township? Is that negotiated, or maybe staff could help us? What is current state law? Or is there anything on that?
Mr. Hines?
I'm sure there's nothing that requires a payment to be made right now. I didn't even know there was a shall, but there's, or a may, but there's definitely no shall.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Marquardt.
Thank you. Because actually, one of the compromises is we're working through local government committee on annexation. I think it would be fair for an X amount of years for a city to pay for the lost property tax base to a township. And I guess the one question I have on this, the difference then on this tax would be whatever the commercial industrial is over the time it was annexed. So actually that fee that would be paid or whatever from the city to the township would probably increase every year as property values went up. And is that correct?
I believe so. And what the intent of the bill is that they would keep the city, the annexing city would keep the current tax base with inflators in it also. And so it would just be the new tax.
And Mr. Chair, and also since you're the author, would this be indefinite or is there a time period? I don't see a time period on this.
Representative Marquardt, it's indefinite at this point, but I think it would be there. You know, the cities have some concerns and they're going to testify, and some of those may need to be addressed in it, but one of those things might be putting a time period on it.
And my final question, Mr. Chair, is your intent, will this go to local government?
Representative Marquardt, is my intent to move it on the floor today to local government with the stipulation that if they act on it, it comes back to Representative Prinke's committee.
I'm sorry, it goes to the floor?
No, we are going to move it today on the floor to local government.
Okay.
So that we can have the discussion there.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Certainly. Anyone else care, Representative Manning?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. That may partially address the question I had. I see at the top of this it says unofficially referred to the Committee on Taxes. I don't recall seeing that on any other bill that's been before us or any of my committees. Has this bill not officially been referred to any committee?
Well,
Mr. Chairman?
Representative Abrams.
The bill was introduced on February 16th as an interim bill. The speaker, under the rules, has the opportunity to refer bills to committees because the House hasn't met for the first reading of the bill. The revised note will say unofficially referred. So if you get it printed at the earlier date before the bill has been officially introduced and received its first reading. So the bill probably is residing in the Tax Committee right now. I don't know if Representative Krinke has sent it down to the Property Tax Division or not.
Mr.
Yes, Representative Lamb.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I'm glad to hear that your intent is to on the House floor to have this move to local government. For those of you that are not on local government, we have dealt with this issue in local government committee, and the feeling of the majority of the committee is that we should not act on this act on it in connection with a review of the whole annexation policy. And we've got now some draft proposals on a committee bill on annexation, and I don't think we ought to be making annexation policy piecemeal. Let the local government committee go through and do its bill and address this and other issues that may arise. And so from my standpoint, this appropriately belongs before the Committee on Local Government.
It's going there, Representative Lanning. Representative Riccardino.
Mr. Chair, Representative Lanning, 8 years ago, this year, in fact, I had a annexation issue in my district between the city of Eveleth and the town of Fail. And I went in front of, I think, Margaret, or Representative Larson, chaired the committee then? I'm not sure.
Representative Larson, Big Larson.
Yeah. Yes. Chaired the committee, and since then we've had many other annexation issues and they haven't been resolved. Now, I kind of like your bill, and I wish your bill just said they just can annex them, period, because they're addressing it. But
we have one of those, Representative.
But on the second page, Mr. Chair, in your bill, you just apply this to on the second page, you apply it to a town located in an metropolitan area. Mm-hmm. And Representative Lanning, since 8 years ago when I tried to solve the whole annexation issue between Fail and Eveleth, I've had another annexation take place between the city of Wawick and the town of White over at Giants Ridge, which Giants Ridge, there was sewer and water out there. And they, and whatever we go to now, there's no municipal board anymore. I see Mr. Fricke's in the audience. I don't know, I can't remember who it went to, but they worked out something similar to what you're doing here, and they said at the time, whatever the tax capacity was, and actually I think not just CI, but you know, other homesteads and that, non-homestead too, and they worked something out between themselves and have an agreement similar to this. But Representative Ryan, my concern is it just doesn't keep, it doesn't get addressed. And I think Representative Vanderveer is trying to do it in his own special way. And, you know, I don't have a problem with trying to help him out if he's willing to take a stand in his district. It's kind of hard sometimes, members. You know, Eblis has just under 5,000 people, and I think Fayal is an urban township with maybe 1,200, 1,300 people, and you take the side of, you know, what you think is right. You know, I'm not a Slobodan Milosevic type person that wants to just take over things without a democracy working, and you know, that seems to be what's been happening in these annexations, and now that we don't have that municipal board to make decisions anymore, it's been piecemeal, Maureen, so I don't know, if it's been 8 years and we still, you know, been fighting to have annexation laws and nothing gets done, and I commend you for taking a creative approach to.
Thank you,
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Nelson. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think Representative Lanning's points are well taken, that obviously everybody knows this does have to go through local government, but I think we should remember what a few years ago Representative Abrams used to call the Tax Committee to order by declaring it as the Committee on of Former Mayors and council members. So I think all of the experience of many of us does kind of cross quite a few committees. Looking at Mark Corp's question as far as sharing funds, I don't know what he did with when he was Mayor Dilworth, but I do know that with the city of Lindstrom and Chisago Lake Township, there were a number of annexations that, and they were all orderly annexations, no exceptions, but where we devised sharing revenue and including the comprehensive plan that we wrote jointly with Chisago Lake Township that stated that certain commercial industrial property would grow into the township and that in fact we would mutually share those revenues, the city and the township. They had the land, we had the services, and therein we get back to the orderly annexations versus the hostile. So just a couple of comments, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Representative Nelson, quickly, I'm going to move approval of the minutes from Thursday, March 9th. Any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, nay. Okay, the motion is adopted. Representative Lanning.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I fully understand and appreciate, Mr. Chairman, your wanting to help your constituents, and I understand the arguments that they're making. To Representative Rukavina, the committee is going to come forward with a bill. What all is going to be in it, we don't know yet. We've got the committee has been going through a process of identifying what members feel should be the goals of this bill. We have a draft that was just handed out to us yesterday of points that might be included. We had hoped, the committee had hoped that people would, the cities, the townships, all the players could come to some kind of consensus on change that they might agree to. Unfortunately, that has not happened, and that's why the committee is taking the initiative and is going to work to develop a bill as a committee.
Well, Representative Lanning, I think it's hard to get the parties to come to an agreement when one has the upper hand in such a clear manner, and I think that's part of the problem that we're trying to, the frustration that members have. Representative Rukavina.
And it is, you know, it is a frustration. I'm just curious, though, how many former mayors or council members do we have on this committee? Raise your hand.
Council mayor.
And then how many former township officers do we have on this committee? Here, right here.
Police civilians.
See? There is the problem.
Well, it always depends on what's in the cake, Representative Rukavina. Chair Mettler.
Chairman Vandeveer, this concept of shared services and cooperation, I'll just point out a couple of things. First of all, we do have and have had a joint powers agreement with the former Forest Lake Township. That was our border, and of course, when Forest Lake was annexed by Forest Lake Township, was Forest Lake annexed by Forest Lake City, those agreements transferred over. So we have got that already in place, and from both the utility standpoint, we also share the fire department, et cetera. Also, we went to Forest Lake in 2001, 2003, and as late as last year, 2005, trying to work something out with the water system because, as I said before, we had sewer in place. That was the big thing. Water, we can buy it. There's several ways you can do it. That's under our control. It's not under the control of Met Council. And Forest Lake wasn't interested in providing those services for various reasons. So we certainly tried the cooperative approach. Simply buying the water would have been an option for us. But, you know, that's water under the bridge now, too.
Looks, Chair Mettler, like you've done good work there, and Forest Lake appreciates and thanks you for it, but would like to just kind of take it. So this is the anti-Pac-Man bill, and with that, there's other, I believe there's some other testimony. Mr. Hines would also like to correct a statement that he made, members.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Michael pointed out to me that there is one, in the case of an annexation by ordinance, there is a provision, there are provisions providing for the city to make townships, payments to the township. It's 90% of the amount they had collected in the first year, then 70%, 50%, 30, and 10. So for 5 years there's some payment. And then we think there also may be provisions for, in the case of bonded debt, that they'd be required to continue to make payments, but I'm not, we haven't exactly found that yet. So.
Mr. Johnson, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Craig Johnson. I represent the League of Minnesota Cities, and to consolidate comments this morning, I am also making my comments on behalf of the Association of Metropolitan Municipalities, the Minnesota Association of Small Cities, and the Coalition of Greater Minnesota Cities. First of all, I would thank the chair and the committee for sending this to local government later for discussion. We've spent a considerable amount of time there discussing overall annexation policy, but also this specific annexation issue, and do believe that is the right place to do some more work on this and to consider what the right moves to do are. I'd raise a couple of specific questions, not to overall annexation policy, but to the tax policy parts that are in this bill. As council just pointed out, already in Chapter 414.033, an annexation by ordinance has a five-year repayment or payment schedule required for townships that starts, as was mentioned, at 90% of the lost town taxes, and over 5 years drops to 10%, the sixth year going to zero. It's to prevent instant loss of tax revenue and allow a phase-in of change of tax base. That's automatic in annexation by ordinance because townships have no say in those. They just occur between individual property owners and a city. In an orderly annexation, any kind of agreement can be worked out between the parties that is allowed through the orderly annexation, and it's an incentive to doing orderly annexation. And in fact, as you heard today, several committee members have had good experiences with that in their areas where a township and city have successfully worked out settling their tax-based differences over a longer period of time if that's needed or appropriate to deal with who is providing what services. That can also be done contractually. If water is going to continue to be provided by one unit of government, there can be a long-term contract designed that continues service from one unit of government to another. And in fact, we encourage units of government to do these cooperative types of service delivery together in a number of fields. A specific concern with this bill is that it appears to be in addition to the required settlement of an annexation by ordinance in Chapter 414.033, So in addition to the 90% payment, you would also have on top of that the 100% payment. The added complication to that is that under fiscal disparities, we don't have 100% of the money. 40% comes off the top in the metro area, so there's another 40% added on top, which could mean we would be paying over 200% of the property tax value in total taxes by a city on a CI property that was annexed. Obviously, that's a great disincentive to annexation, Mr. Chair, if that's the goal, but it's a significant multiplication of tax impacts that goes far beyond any taxes that would be collected by that unit of government. This also goes in perpetuity. It is not limited in duration. It is for the, once the land is annexed, it will always have its tax base going to the other unit of government. And then finally, I think it sets up a very strange incentive for townships. Once the land under this language is zoned as commercial industrial, even if it's undeveloped commercial industrial, it receives this protection. And this tax penalty for being annexed, which sets up the case that you could have the land zoned as commercial undeveloped commercial industrial right into your comprehensive plan for your unit of government, that if it ever develops as commercial industrial, you will provide service, and nothing can be done with it. So I have a number of concerns about how that would play out over the long term as a disincentive to good development planning for the property. The final concern is one that I raised on a similar bill that was discussed in local government committee earlier this week, dealing with the definition of urban towns on the bill. And the concern with that is that urban town is not a defined term in statute. There are several different ways towns can be declared urban. One is the 1963 statute that was handed around to you that talked about Anoka County villages. We also have special legislation throughout statute hidden all over the place that creates different urban towns throughout the state, not just in the metro area, as the town of White and others have done. And there's also statute 368.01, which says that any town with 1,200 or more people and has platted property within 20 miles of the downtown of a city of the first class may become an urban town if they choose to by ordinance. They don't have to report that. They can do it on their own. So we actually don't know which ones have decided to do that, but any could. So urban town's definition is very loose. This could affect a larger number of communities than just the situation you're hearing about today of Forest Lake and Columbus Township. Mr. Chair, that would conclude my comments.
Well, thank you, Mr. Johnson. I think some of those we should consider. But it's your opinion that this might make it less desirable to annex land under certain circumstances?
Mr. Chair, as I commented, yes, I think having to pay out taxes to the township that are more than 200% of what you can collect off the property would be a disincentive to annexation.
But Mr. Johnson, I do have one question. The payout that Mr. Hines described that's currently made when there's an annexation, that's based on the existing tax base, correct? And probably wouldn't take into consideration, even other than the bonding that he was discussing, the investment in infrastructure that a township may have made in an area.
Mr. Chair, that requirement only refers to lost tax base, but there are other provisions of annexation law that refer to recovery of stranded costs. It's actually very normal in annexation now that recovery of assessed improvements that have been made in a property are dealt with during the annexation settlement process. So,
but Mr. Johnson, that is based on the ALJ's kind of interpretation sometimes too, isn't it?
Mr. Chair, the ALJ does have some authority to decide what types of settlements should be in an annexation, yes.
Thank you. Any questions for Mr. Johnson? Thank you. Mr. Hines?
Mr. Chairman, I think the testifier may be wrong about the 200% because the 90% payment would relate to the tax base in existence at the time of the annexation, and this bill would only relate to the tax base that was added on after the annexation. So I think you wouldn't get to a situation where you'd ever be over even 100%. The fiscal disparities, I think, is a valid point that is not addressed. But as far as the getting the 200%, I don't believe that's possible.
Mr. Chair, I will certainly look at the bill to see if I read that section wrong, but I'm guessing counsel's read it more thoroughly than I have, so I'll take that advice. Thank you.
Mr. Hines drafted it, but it also had the it does deal with just the new or the increment in the new development, and the existing tax would still be treated the same way, as was my understanding and intent. So. Although maybe it should be the other way. No. Anyone else care to testify for or against House File 2683? Okay. Seeing none, the chair will lay the bill over, and we'll move on to the report from the Department of Revenue.
Mr. Folkman, or whoever wants to start, go right ahead, please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Gordon Folkman, Director of the Property Tax Division, Department of Revenue, and we're here today to give you an overview of the legislative mandated report on resort assessment practices. With me today is Gary Amundson, who is a rep who represents the Property Tax Division and works with the counties in northeastern Minnesota, and Steve Kuha, who's the county assessor for Cass County. Gary is also the one who was the lead person on the working group that we formed to address the resort practices issue. If you recall last year, I think there were a number of issues that came before the legislature with respect to resort property, including property tax levels as well as assessment practices. And the legislature did take action last year to address some of the property tax concerns, and if you recall, they did two important changes in current law. One is they eliminated what was called the 500 by 800 foot box limitation that applied to the 1C resort to be qualified for 1C. The other change that they made was they changed the classification structure for 1C property. 1C property under old law had a 1% class rate, and under the changes that were adopted last year, there's now a three-tier system. The first $500,000 is subject to a 0.55 classification rate. The value between $500,000 and $2.2 million is a 1% class rate, and the value above 2.2% has a 1.25 class rate. As a result of these changes, based on estimates done by House Research at the end of last session, approximately 26% of tax relief was provided to 1C property and about 18% overall to 1C and 4C property. So there were some significant changes made to some of the property tax issues with respect to resort property last year. In addition, number of issues were brought before the committee with respect to the uniformity of valuation practices, and as a result of that, the legislature mandated the department to do a number of reports, including this one on resorts. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Gary Amundson to give you an overview of the issues and recommendations that the working committee came up with, and Steve Kuha will also make a few comments, and both will be available for questions from the committee.
Mr. Allison, go right ahead. Introduce yourself for the tape, of course.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. Thank you for allowing us to come and share some of our analysis on resort assessments this morning. My name is Gary Amundson. As Mr. Folkman said, I'm a regional representative within the department. I act as a liaison between the department and counties. I currently represent 14 counties in Minnesota, and I represent a number of the counties that have significant amounts of resort property. And as Mr. Folkman stated, I facilitated the work of this group in formulating these recommendations that you have before you today. Resorts have been an integral part of our Minnesota culture for decades now. Many of us have fond memories of summers spent at Minnesota resorts. As a child, I spent parts of many summers at a resort on Woman Lake near Longville, Minnesota, in Cass County, where Mr. Kuhl works. And we stayed in a cabin. And the cabin had two bedrooms. In one bedroom was a double bed, and another was a bunk bed. In the other part of the cabin, there was one room that was the kitchen, dining room, living room. It had a two-burner hot plate, an apartment-sized refrigerator, and some wicker furniture. Available for our recreation was a swimming beach, a flat-bottom 14-foot boat, and a 5-horse Champion motor. Also included was a pair of oars, because the Champion motor didn't always work. And I remember rowing quite a bit during our time at that Woman Lake. The resort industry, though, since that time, has changed and is changing due to many economic influences and cultural changes, which include increasing property values, increasing operating costs, increased competition for resort patrons, as we have many, many more recreational opportunities available to us now, and occupants higher expectations for amenities and services from resort patrons. These changes all make classifying and valuing resort properties for tax purposes much more challenging. Our purpose in this undertaking was to study assessments of resort property and formulate policies and recommend legislative changes that would foster increased uniformity in resort assessments. To accomplish this, we formed a working group made up of department personnel and county assessment staff. The county assessment staff included representatives from Cass County, Becker County, Mille Lacs County, Crow Wing County, Douglas County, Hennepin County, and Beltrami County. One of the things that became immediately apparent to us as we began our work was that one of the problems that was creating some lack of uniformity in resort assessments was some ambiguity in the statutes that outline the way resort assessments are to be made. Mr. Folkman mentioned earlier that some changes, and we feel some improvements were made in the statutes last year. We would applaud your efforts in getting rid of the box, the imaginary 800 by 500 square foot sphere that had to encompass all the resort property. This report today would be much longer if you had not done that last year, so we thank you for that. Our working group believes that the best way to promote assessment uniformity is for the legislature to adopt some key clarifications to statutory language and for the Department of Revenue to adopt some concise policies in areas not requiring legislative changes and issue a bulletin outlining resort assessment procedures and guidelines. We began the first of our four meetings by surveying assessors about their assessment practices with regard to resorts. We then identified some areas of inconsistency and formulated recommendations to remedy those inconsistencies. With your indulgence, I'll go over some of those areas now. I don't plan on talking about all of them. We'll focus on the ones that would require some legislative action, where we're requesting some statutory change in the language. The first area we looked at was the valuation of resort property. Last year, as I understand, I wasn't privy to personally, but there was some discussion in the legislature about inconsistencies in valuing resorts across the state for tax purposes. Comparing resort values is very difficult because, as we've just said, the properties are very unique and they vary greatly from area to area and from county to county. So it's hard to compare values. In addition, sales of resorts are relatively scarce. So it's difficult to compare the performance of one county in valuing resort versus another because of the lack of that sales data that exists. One of the things that must be understood in talking about valuing resorts is the concept of highest and best use. And last week at the Woodlands Report, one of my colleagues talked to you about the concept of highest and best use. I don't want to spend a lot of time talking about that here, but very, very quickly, the concept of highest and best use is really just looking at the reasonably probable and legal uses of property and finding which are physically possible, appropriately supported, and financially feasible, and then choosing the result which returns the highest value to the property. And that was a question that we asked assessors. How do you value resorts? Is it based on the highest and best use of the property? Is it based on the value of the property as a resort? Or is it based on some other considerations? A number of assessors responded that they valued the property based on the value of the property as a resort. In fact, the majority did. A smaller number said they valued the property at its highest and best use. Within our statutes, where it says we're to value property at its market value, inherent within that definition is the concept of highest and best use. In exploring further what they said, we asked them to give us a concise description of the methods they used to value resorts. And we found that although they differed in philosophy, some said they valued them as resorts, some said they valued them at their highest and best use, there really were minimal differences in the way they valued resorts. Some counties identified highest and best use, which in this case could be as development property. A resort may have its highest and best use a development use or a resort use. Others said we're just going to look at the resort use. But what they did was they would value the property, a county that said they valued it based on highest and best use, according to what it might sell for to a developer. Another county would value the property based on its use as a resort, but then recognize that intensive use and increase the value because there's intensive use of the land. And what we found was that in the end results, the values weren't that different as well as we could compare. So what we're recommending with regard to valuation of resorts is that we simply uphold the standard that currently is in place in law and that resorts be valued at their highest and best use. And we will encourage assessors to do that. That will not require any action by your committee or on the part of the legislature. The next few items that I'd like to address are items that we think will help clarify the definition of a resort, which, as we said earlier, is more difficult to do today, and will help us in classifying resorts more consistently across the state. We found more inconsistency in the classification of resorts than there was in the valuation of resort property. Some of these changes that I'm going to talk about are quite technical in nature and won't have a lot of impact on resort taxes in general. Others are changes that could possibly have some impact on some properties across the state. One of the things that again, Mr. Fulton mentioned is that last year the legislature changed the taxation from resorts from a system with a box to a tiered system, where a certain amount of value is taxed at one rate and the next value is taxed at a higher rate. We again applaud that decision. That made the assessment and classification of resorts for assessors much more easily administered, and I think it made it much more easily understood by taxpayers as well. And we thank you for that. One of the impacts that's going to have, though, is that resorts now have a very favorable classification. And we feel that because of that, there will be individual taxpayers who will seek to gain the resort class because it's one of the most favorable classes in property tax right now. And because of that, we think that there should be a minimum number of units that a resort should have to have in order to qualify for that favorable classification. If you go out now and you Google vacation rentals Walker, you will find that there's a ton of vacation rental property out there that's being offered right now. Not all of them are resorts. Some of them are privately owned properties. Some of them are guest cabins at homes that exist out there. And for this reason, we think it's important that there be a minimum number of units that a resort must have in order to receive the resort classification. We're recommending that number be 5. And we chose that number because that number is stated in the Department of Health statutes where they define resorts and list the requirements for licensing.
Mr. Anderson, excuse me. However, do you think there's a good impact or a bad impact to having a lot more vacation housing, rental housing available in the state? I know that might be out of your area of expertise, but wouldn't that be a plus for tourism and that kind of thing?
Mr. Chairman, it's a plus for tourism. It's probably good for Minnesota. It creates competition for resorts. And that's, I guess, neither here nor there as far as this policy goes. I guess our point with this is that should an individual who owns a lake home and has a guest cabin and rents that guest cabin out on a weekly basis during the summer, receive the resort classification.
I see.
And if we assign a minimum number of units that a resort must have, then that will exclude properties like that from receiving the resort classification.
Thank you.
We suggested the number 5. We're not married to that number. We think there should be a number. We surveyed assessors on that. They think it should be somewhere from 3 to 5. If the committee decided as a matter of policy that they would choose a different number, we have no strong feeling about that. 3 is another number that may have some logic to it because that's the separation point between non-residential homestead property and apartments.
Mm-hmm.
those options are there, and we leave those options to you.
Does the class rate, Mr. Amundson, that with the resorts, does that require an owner-occupant to get the most favorable rate, or wasn't that part of the...
Mr. Chairman, the most favorable rate is the 1C classification, which we call the Ma and Pa Resort. Mm-hmm. That one requires homestead occupancy.
Okay.
The other one is Class 4C, which is a resort that does not contain the homestead of the owner and does not necessarily abut a lakeshore line.
Okay. Thank you. Continue.
Okay. The second thing that we would like to see clarified in legislation and statutes is that in conjunction with a resort, there also be the offering of some recreational activities. In the statute as it exists now, there is no requirement for a resort to offer recreational activities. And we think that's an important way of distinguishing a resort from a hotel or a motel in that case. And we're suggesting things like rental of fishing boats, rental of ice houses, downhill skis, cross-country skis, things like that that a resort should offer as far as recreational activities in order to qualify for this classification. And we think that's a relatively basic requirement that should be included in the definition of a resort. The third thing is that current statute for the 1C classification, which is the most favorable class, which requires the property to contain the homestead for the owner, this current statute says it abuts a lakeshore line. And this is probably a very technical issue, but there are a number of resorts in Minnesota that abut rivers and bodies of water like that. As a matter of policy, we have been recommending to those counties for a number of years that they grant that resort classification to properties that abut the river rather than a lake. We're simply asking here that language be amended to include lakes and rivers or meandered bodies of water or, you know, whatever the committee feels would address that issue. Just a clarification that we can use. Another one that's fairly technical in nature, the current statute references the fact that a Class 1C resort with any value in the third tier of classification then must meet all the requirements of the 4C class in order to get the classification on the entire resort. We're recommending that language be stricken from the statute. What that's doing is it's basing the classification on not on the use of the property, but on the value of the resort. And we could foresee a situation where a resort may wobble back and forth between that top tier and that bottom tier, and the classification could change from year to year. And we just feel the classification should be based on its use and not its value. Again, probably a relatively minor technical change. Further, we would like to see a definition of what a rental unit is. The statute now references cottages or cabins or something like that, and it doesn't define what a rental unit is. And we think some very simple language, like defining a rental unit as a cabin, a condominium, a townhouse, a sleeping room, or a camping pad with electrical and water hookups, will help us more clearly delineate what actually a resort consists of and administer the assessment of resorts across the state more effectively and more efficiently. The last thing that I would mention, I guess, that we would request some legislative clarification on is a phenomenon that's fairly recent in resorts in Minnesota, and it's a phenomenon where, in many cases, resorts are transferring ownership or the right to use individual units to individuals. They either do that through the sale of the unit by a deeded interest to an individual, or they form a corporation and sell shares to an individual that grants that individual the right to use that unit. If an individual buys that unit and just uses it for personal use, we have no problem with that. It's a seasonal residential recreational property. Oftentimes now those units are staying in the rental pool, and they're being managed by the resort, and they continue to be rented on a weekly or nightly basis. It's our feeling, and it's the feeling of the assessors that we surveyed, that those parcels, those units in which the ownership has been transferred, no longer qualify for the resort class. And we would like to see that delineated in statute. We think those properties should be classified as seasonal, residential, recreational, which again would be supported by the fact that one unit alone does not constitute a resort. And we're asking that language be also added to the legislation that's being proposed here. There are a number of other issues that we address that can be handled administratively, issues such as allocating the land value to the resort portion, or to the homestead portion of the resort, classifying excess land that's not used for resort purposes, the determination of the use of which types of sales are used in measuring resort assessments. And I can talk about those if you wish. Otherwise, as I said, those are issues that we can handle administratively that probably won't require any legislative action. And I guess at this point I would leave that up to you if you want to pursue any of those further issues or if you've heard enough.
Any additional questions on this from any members?
I think Mr. Kruha wanted to make a statement if we're almost finished. Sir.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Steve Kruha. I'm the Cass County Assessor. Please excuse me. I'm recovering from my annual sinus condition, so I'll make my comments as brief as possible. But I wanted to remind you that last session about this time of the year, you were listening to folks coming before you, constituents and taxpayers, criticizing and sharing their confusion over assessment practices and the way the property tax system works. And that's certainly understandable. It's a complex system. You did the right thing by listening to them and asking yourselves, what's the problem? What can we be doing about it? And you did the right thing also by directing the Department of Revenue to conduct a study and report back to you and offer recommendations of how the system can be improved. And now you have that report in front of you, and I just urge you to do something with it. Too many times in the past, we recall governor's commissions, or blue ribbon task forces conduct studies and reports, and they only get laid on a shelf to gather dust and really never see the light of day. Don't let that happen to this report. Do something with it. I'd be proud of any legislator who'd author or co-author and support some legislation that would pick up on these ideas and actually enact them into law. So just want to offer the support from my position on this, and I'd be willing to answer any questions if there arise. Thank you.
Thank you. And I would like to thank you for your work on this. This is... appears to be very common sense and reasonable, and I think you've done a good job. This is government, though. We will probably know. but we will look through this, and problem being the short session, but I think we want to look at the two reports, the last one we've had, and it would be nice maybe if you care to join us, and I'd like to meet with the department and any members that would like to, and maybe pick some of the actions that should clearly be done and attempt to get that put into some legislation this year. So, Representative Broad.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just have a question regarding something on page 7. It deals with both real and personal property in terms of the classifications. And I'm just wondering how personal property fits in and what you had envisioned when you look at the changes that you're requesting.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Broad, the reference there between real and personal property would probably include camping units such as park trailers and things like that would be assessed as personal property rather than assessed as real estate. And the distinction there is simply whether they're on land that's owned by the owner of the unit or land that's owned by someone else.
Mr. Chairman?
Representative Brad.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you very much. Is there a definition, then, of the personal property that would be included? I guess a little bit concerned over just using personal property and then not knowing what's included in that personal property definition. Is it the boat that's sitting there? Is it just that camper? Maybe defining that a little bit better, or maybe it's already there.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Broad, personal property is well known to assessors as far as what personal property is taxable in Minnesota and what personal property is not taxable in Minnesota. And if you're concerned about taxing boats and motors and things like that, they're clearly exempt from tax.
Mr. Chairman, and that's defined? You said it's known, but is it defined in statute?
Yes, it is.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
If I may make a comment on that last question as well. We wanted to include personal property as well as real property because we do have a number of resorts that are not on property that they own. There are resorts operating on Indian lease land, on federal or state lands, and the entire operation is not considered real property. It is personal property. So the statute did not cover that in terms of personal property in the past, and this was included in the recommendation so that resorts that are truly personal property resorts on leased land would be included under these provisions.
Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and to the members that are left here. You know, Mr. Kuha talked about some of the hearings that we had last year, and we took a lot of that testimony, and we went into the different people's backyards. We had three different visits around the state with Mr. Folkman, Mr. Hagan, and House staff out there, and where a person would anticipate that we would be entering into a hornet's nest. I think that as the department laid out the explanation of where their tax issues were coming from, the people were starting to understand it, and it's my opinion that without exception that every one of those three site visits was very successful in educating the public that was there, and we know that there was large numbers in many of those rooms, and I think that it would be very helpful. I don't know that how you'd ever mandate or regulate, but I just think that if the department could come with something similar, those examples, if local units of government would also take a little bit of time twice a year to explain to the taxpayers that show up with an issue with their tax statement or the valuation of their property what the implications are and where things come from and where they're going to end up going. I think that communication is very important, just as the requiring these different open books rather than the short 2 or 3 hour meetings. I think providing the opportunity for the public to get information and get educated is going to make a lot of difference in the understanding. So just kind of a commentary there.
Okay. Any other questions for members?
Go ahead. Just one concluding comment, Mr. Chairman. Just to find out what's in your report, I guess as I looked at the report after it's published, I thought we should have put an index in it. Within the appendix of your report, the resort survey is contained on page 15. The survey responses are contained on pages 18 through 26. A listing of resort market value by county is on pages 27 through 30, so you can see where the resorts are within the state. County average effective tax rates by property type are listed on pages 31 and 34. For two taxes, that's kind of interesting. You can see the effect of the legislation you passed last year on effective tax rates within various counties across the state. And finally, the county average resort tax base by tax county is listed on pages 35 through 38. And with that, I thank you for your time.
Brad, then we will take testimony from the audience if they'd like.
Okay. I'm sorry, Mr. Chair. I should have asked the question earlier. I'm looking on page 9 in regards to that rental unit when they're sold, and I think that's an interesting discussion to have. I'm interested in the true application and what that means on the ground, and maybe I just need more information about it. I'm intrigued by what you're trying to do, but I'm looking for situational impacts and applications of it. If you have anything like that, not now, but maybe secondary from here, I'd really appreciate that information. I think I just need to understand it better.
I can say that what we're recommending here is upholding current practice. An example is Izaides Resort in Mille Lacs. Pretty much all the units are owned by individuals, but those units are maintained in the rental pool of Izaides Resort. Currently, the Mille Lacs County Assessor has valued each of those individually owned units as a single seasonal residential recreational property rather than as part of the resort. And they're classified on a unit-by-unit basis with the resort. So if that clarifies some of your concerns.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And maybe what you could do is using that as an example. It's a great example. If you can just maybe get me at some point the differences in terms of what they pay and the on the ground impact of treating it one way or the other. I think that would be helpful.
Mr. Folkman.
Mr. Chair, I just want to just follow up on Representative Nelson's comments, because one of the things we're trying to do at the department is try and put more emphasis on education and information. That the committee hearings that were held out state certainly contributed to that. And as resources allow, I just want to assure the committee that we're going to try and do our best to not only work with the public, work with local officials, but work with assessors on the communication message of a very complicated system. And I think over time it should have some benefits.
Thank you. Would anyone in the audience care to comment? Mr. Carlson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. My name is Joel Carlson. I'm here on behalf of the Congress of Minnesota Resorts and the Congress of Resorts and Hospitality Minnesota Inc. And Mr. Day and Mr. Quillis are here, and I don't know if they want to separately provide their comments, but I think theirs would probably echo what I would just like to share with the committee briefly, and that is that we asked for this assessment study in the Tax Conference Committee last session. We appreciate the survey that's in here, because there is at least at a minimum a perception of unequal assessment among various counties, and I think the survey work that they've done here is excellent and can address that perception among the various counties. And so I'd like to applaud and thank the assessors for the quality of the work product that they put in front of you. Just in reviewing them today, I think that resorters would embrace many of the recommendations that are in the report, and we do need to take a closer look at a couple of them. In particular, the recommendation, which I believe is at the bottom of page 3, which would potentially shift more resort property into a commercial status, which could change your class rate from 1% to 3%. Is an issue that we would want to watch very carefully. And we also have an ongoing debate going on within the resort community as it relates to ownership, the number of units to classify for resort 1C property tax classification, and the changing nature of resort ownership. As land values increase, resorters are constantly looking for unique ownership methods to allow them to cash flow their operation, with potentially having individual aspects of the resort in other ownership, not just held by the resort in fee. And so, you know, as you look at that definition of resort ownership and how that impacts their tax status, we're going to want to watch that very carefully, because one of the things that they're able to do now, which we don't want to preclude, is have alternative forms of ownership that allow them to stay in business, meet the 250-day requirement, and still retain the beneficial tax status that they have. And we want to make sure that we don't impact that and move that property into commercial status, because that will have the unintended but opposite effect of just selling those properties off for full residential use, and then that lake access to those that use that lake on a temporary seasonal basis is going to be gone. So we want to watch that very carefully. With that, happy to answer any questions, Mr. Chair. But we do appreciate the work of the department and the assessors in putting this report together at our request.
So, Mr. Carlson, what do you have an opinion on the? Or is there a consensus in the industry on the number of units, having a minimum number of units?
Mr. Chairman and members, we've looked at that issue, and we went through, and I'll share that with the committee, through the chairman's office. He can email that to the members. We went through a resort definition with an alternative shoreland management process, and I'd like to email that definition to you. It does vary slightly from what's before you. To the extent you have a cabin owner or a lakeshore owner that is renting their cabin that is on their contiguous parcel on a seasonal basis, Whether they are classified as a resort or not, we don't know that that has a significant difference in their tax status. If it is still on as instead of residence and it's still on as residential property, it's at 1%. If it's homestead resort, it's 1%. I don't know if we're arguing about something on the edges there that doesn't make a lot of difference. The issue of just residential property, vacation properties that they talk about, you know, that are available for rent, is, I think, a different issue than the classification of them as a resort. There are health department issues and others that do raise some questions.
Okay, thank you. Any other questions from members? Anyone in the audience care to testify?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members.
All right. Thank you, members. I think with that, then, we will adjourn.